Thank you all for being here. Welcome to our next panel. Our moderator is David Santel, so without further, we'll start our panel. Judge.
Good afternoon. We're going to be talking this afternoon about the direction of federalism in the Roberts Court, which will necessitate, I guess, talking about the direction of federalism before the Roberts Court. Some of us thought we had the direction figured out at the time of the Lopez decision and the Morrison case. In fact, I went around the countryside between the two to various Federalist chapters lecturing on Lopez Speaks, is anyone listening? After Morrison, I thought maybe people would listen, and then after Raich, I didn't know what they would hear if they did listen. So hopefully we have panelists who will straighten out all of the questions that we may all have about what that direction is. In the order in which I think they're going to be presenting, I believe, Walter, you're first. We'll be starting with my old friend and fellow Tar Heel, Walter Dellinger. We were at Carroll UNC together many years ago. He found it surprising that I could not remember him. I told him he must not have hung out in bars, or I would have known him much better. But he was a big man on campus. Then he went off to some Ivy League school. I've forgotten which one. They all look alike. Distinguished himself in many ways later, including teaching at Duke University Law School, which is near a great university in North Carolina, and also serving as Solicitor General for a time during the Clinton administration. I believe batting second, if I get any of these wrong, you fellas just jump up in the order you want to come up in, will be Dr. John Eastman, the Dean and Donald Kennedy Chair in Law at Chapman University School of Law. Along the way, he clerked for the Honorable Clarence Thomas and is an old friend of the Federalist Society. He has actually practiced law as well as been an academic, which has the admiration of those of us who went to law school so we could practice law. Being a judge is a little like practicing law, except it doesn't pay as well. Third, we'll have Jeff Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, legal affairs editor of the New Republic, and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. His most recent book is The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. I have no idea what I just dropped here, but there it is. And everything still seems to be working.
You clicked on it and get to watch Oprah.
I wouldn't take a chance on that. We might lose the audience for good then. And batting cleanup is going to be Paul Clement, who was the 43rd Solicitor General of the United States and is currently a visiting professor at the Georgetown University Law Center and a senior fellow at the Center's Supreme Court Institute. Paul, a pleasure to see you again. So I think that's the order you're going in. If you want to change it, but nobody will notice. Walter, you're first. And they get about 8 or 10 minutes to directly present, and I'm going to let them talk to each other, and then we'll have questions from the audience.
In his great book, Order and Law, about his time as Solicitor General, Charles Freed writes about an incident that, to me, really exemplifies a significant part of the debate over federalism. A case came up to his office in which the Solicitor General had the option to enter as an amicus on behalf of the United States, involving what Charles saw as Lilliputian provincial regulations hampering national commerce and a national free market. And his family, having come from Eastern Europe to escape the sort of Brezhnevian-type regimes, he had eagerly left his post at Harvard to come to argue the Reagan Revolution, the central tenet of which he saw as free markets and liberating the entrepreneurial spirit of America from the hamstringing of multiplicity of governmental regulations. So we filed a strong brief arguing that the particular set of state regulations in this case were preempted by the national authority of the United States, and circulated this draft brief around the Justice Department when he reports that basically an explosion goes off at the Office of Legal Counsel, what Charles refers to as the state's rights police, headed by our friend Charles Cooper, who said this brief violates the central purpose of the Reagan Revolution, which is state's rights. And a vigorous battle then ensued over which of these two principles, free markets or state regulatory authority, represents the heart of what each of them thought they had come to Washington to advocate and to achieve. That particular debate was resolved in Assistant Attorney General Cooper's favor by General Meese. But the debate is one that goes on and is, in a sense, a timeless debate. There is a genuine fissure in sort of conservative legal thought between the twin poles of states' rights on the one hand and freedom from excessive and multiplicitous and often inconsistent regulation on the other. One question is, as I slightly broaden this topic to federalism in the era of Obama, is whether there's a similar fissure in thought on the other side. There's a traditional progressive position of people who grew up as I did in the South, where we thought of states' rights as George Corley Wallace standing in the schoolhouse door. But more recently, plaintiffs, tort lawyers, environmentalists, and others have sought out state regulation, particularly in an era of the past 8 years where they saw relatively less regulatory zeal at the national level. All of a sudden, for a variety of reasons, states became much more active in more segments of the economy. Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, in a sense, led the charge, but the tobacco settlement gave it an enormous impetus, where state attorneys general's offices began to see themselves as revenue centers for the state. And attorneys general were often successful in running for governor, reversing a trend where lieutenant governors had beaten attorneys general. In the era where they became revenue centers for their states and much more aggressive, and when they discovered the technique of bringing in plaintiffs' tort firms on a contingency basis at no cost to the state, where you then had this amalgam of the authority of the state as a litigant with the profit incentive of contingency fee lawyers, you saw a very great transformation in the legal landscape. And a major shift. It took a while, and all of a sudden, the state's rights looks more appealing to people who want to urge more liability on corporations, more recovery, more punitive damages, more regulatory protections. One question as we look to the new era is whether that will look different if you think of the party of regulation coming into national office, whether those people who, once they become regulators and once their agency has struck what they think is the right balance between cost and efficiency, consumer want, satisfaction, safety, environmental concerns, have struck whatever the right balance is, will be as eager to see 50 states be free to add to and have conflicting regulations. So that is one way in which the balance between state and national authority, I think, will be up for additional debate. Secondly, one question is whether it may, at some level, influence the courts if there is more active regulation at the national level, will courts be as inclined to foster and to facilitate a multiplicity of state regulators when Congress has been ambiguous about the degree to which Congress is preempting a state law? For example, there was a very revealing moment in the argument two terms ago in Waters versus Wachovia when my now colleague Sri Srinivasan was arguing on behalf of the United States in favor of federal preemption of state regulation, not just of federal banks, but also of their operating subsidiaries that were doing mortgage loans. And when those mortgage subsidiaries became part of the national banks, did national preemption from state regulation follow? Justice Stevens asked right off the bat, how many additional regulators were added to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency once you took on this new responsibility? And the answer was, that's an empirical question, but that I don't know the answer to, but they felt that they had the authority, the resources to regulate both. But the point that Justice Stevens was making is, I'm skeptical that you're really going to be regulating this at the national level. You're ousting state regulation, but are you really going to be regulating? So that, I think, is a factor that will be in the background. A final factor will be the increasing role in the economic area that we've seen recently of multinational agreements. The present administration has accepted a number of regulations and standards recently from a group of 20 nations that we've agreed to implement as part of the response to the fiscal crisis. Whatever you think of the wisdom of having that kind of multinational agreement, it becomes possible only if the federal government is going to have the authority to speak for the United States. I think we're increasingly facing a world in which, given that there's a 400 million person common market in Europe, the idea that the United States will now become like the balkanization of Europe in the 1950s, with 50 different systems of regulations facing our businesses, whereas European-centered operations will have an extraordinarily common market, will make it very, very difficult for us to compete. My bias is in favor of preemption here, and I will just close with one comment on the summary of state sovereignty. I once did a two-minute summary of all. I think all the constitutional law can be summarized in 2 minutes, and any of you that ask, I'll give you the other minute and 45 seconds, but the 15 seconds on state sovereignty is this. The national power of Congress is limited to some extent by state sovereignty, a doctrine traditionally invoked by those on the right to insulate conservative red state practices from federal regulation. The doctrine is now being eyed fondly but warily by liberals seeking to protect blue state positions on gay marriage, medical marijuana, punitive damages, environmental regulations. The rule of thumb is this. State sovereignty claims are much more likely to be upheld by the current court when they're advanced by Alabama than when they're put forward by Oregon. Thank you.
Boy, following Walter Dellinger, but following Mark Stein as well, is quite a task. We're trying to figure out exactly what the Roberts Court federalism is, and is it alive and well, or is it deader than a doorknob? Before we can answer that question, I think it's important that we understand what federalism is. Simplistically, it means any case in which a state wins, that's a good federalism decision, and when states lose, it's a bad federalism decision. But, of course, those of us that recognize the importance of an intervening constitution are a little more nuanced than that. If a power is within the federal government's power, then when the state loses to a legitimate exercise of federal power, that's advancing our federalism, this separation of powers between the two levels of government. And when the federal government is exceeding its authority and nevertheless wins, that would be a violation of federalism. Or when the states are acting in ways contrary to that federal charter, that would be a violation of federalism as well. So let's lead up to the Roberts courts by looking at, I think, two eras of the Rehnquist court and try and figure out how they did on this question of federalism, and then see whether the Roberts court is carrying forward the proper understanding of federalism or not. I divide this between the early Rehnquist court and the late Rehnquist court. And for simplicity, I'm not going to go through all of their potential federalism decisions, but a couple of the big ones. In the early Rehnquist court, you get cases like Lopez and Morrison and Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County, clearly restricting the scope of the commerce power and much more in line with the original design of the Constitution, leaving the remainder for states to regulate or not as they saw fit. Very good and very strong originalist federalism decisions. But you also had from that early Rehnquist court such cases as term limits, which did just the opposite. And I would argue, Walter's already hinted at this, the 11th Amendment cases. That's something we don't often think about. But here was a set of actions of where there was clear federal authority granted in Article 1, Section 8, and yet we're creating this preserve of exemption for the states. And that seems to be somehow at tension with the notion of constitutional assignments of power in the federal system. So you've got this little bit of a mixed message in the early Rehnquist court. In the late Rehnquist court, I don't think you have any mixed message at all. You've got cases like Race, which seem to repudiate all the old Commerce Clause cases, or more appropriately, I think, defined in Lopez, we left open, illogically left open, whether Lopez overrules Wickard versus Filburn. Race comes along where that issue is directly confronted and sides with Wickard versus Filburn, not with Lopez. But you also have a very interesting implied presidential foreign powers preemption case in American Insurance Association versus Garamendi, written by Justice Souter. The dissenters in the case are an interesting line of pro-federalist justices, Ruth Ginsburg and John Paul Stevens, as well as Justice Scalia and Thomas. And so you've got a very mixed bag of intrusion now on states' exercise of their police powers. And then one more I'll throw in there as well, Lawrence versus Texas, where using an amorphous interpretation of provisions of the 14th Amendment, Justice Kennedy writes a decision greatly intruding on the ability of the states to exercise their police powers. So I think it's fair to say that the late era of the Rehnquist court, we'd lost our way on this definition of federalism that I've given out. So let's see where we are with the Roberts court. Chief Justice Roberts is starting his fourth term. Justice Alito also in his fourth term, although not quite as long on the first term as Justice Roberts was. There's an old adage that lingers in the halls of the court. You really don't know why you've been there until you've been there 5 years, and then after that you wonder why everybody else is there. But they are starting to make their mark. The first term, the case that comes out, now this is actually before Justice Alito takes the bench and Justice O'Connor is still voting, 6-3 Gonzales versus Oregon. And in fact, this upholds the right of states to regulate assisted suicide drugs against the regulation at the federal government that tried to prevent that. I thought, wonderful. I don't like the underlying state issue, but I like the right of the states to be able to make these experiments on their own. What a great federalism decision. I'm going to look at that 6-3, and I just know I'm going to see Justice Roberts and Scalia and Thomas in the majority for this great federalism decision. And it's not. They're all in dissent. What's going on here? Well, Justice Scalia, of course, the case is decided on non-delegation grounds and deference grounds, and the lurking federalism issue and states' rights issue never really comes to the forefront, except in the important opinion by Justice Thomas in dissent. Now, his is not a rejection of the underlying federalism principles. His is a perplexity that a court that just the prior term had issued the opinion in Raich, depriving the state of California of its ability to regulate medical marijuana, homegrown with no interstate commerce in this at all, and I'm not a big fan of medical marijuana either, even though I'm from California. Yes, Sprouts is the better thing for us. But he writes, I don't know how a court that just issued Raich cannot recognize the same principles at stake in Gonzales versus Oregon either. Now, he would, of course, overrule the whole lot of it and gone back to Lopez, but trying to get some consistency there. Now, the Roberts Court, though, I think has then taken this and gotten a little more nuanced. We end up with a case, though, in Rapanos. instead of adopting the Lopez line, we end up with Justice Kennedy taking center seat in a swing decision, creating a new balancing test. Rapanos is an interesting case, and I look forward to welcoming Solicitor General Clement back to the private sector and see if he adheres as much to the line he took in the brief there as he will back in the private sector. But here's a case that involved a gentleman's land that had some water on it. We called it wetlands, and some of the water flows under a 100-year-old man-made drain pipe under a road into a creek across the road called Hoppler Creek. And from Hoppler Creek, it makes its way down to the Coquelon River, down the Coquelon River to Saginaw Bay, some 26 miles away before we get to the navigable waters of Lake Huron. This was allowed to be regulated by the Corps of Engineers under the theory that it was connected to navigable waters 26 miles away. Now, the court reverses that decision, but does so with Justice Kennedy writing a concurring, an opinion concurring in the judgment, creating a great deal of ambiguity on what's within the federal power or not, a multi-part balancing test and standards and factors to consider on whether this is close enough to navigable water. I mean, there wasn't anything issue about navigation. There's no exercise of commerce here, no trade. It was really the exercise of a police power. If we had been operating under the earlier Rehnquist court, I think it's fair to say that the Lopez majority would have said, you know, where is the Commerce Clause connection here, and given us a vastly different decision than we have here. So the whole Commerce Clause revolution of the early Rehnquist court seems to be gone. But then on the other hand, well, let me go to the 11th Amendment cases, because I think one thing the court has done is get this balance, this nuance on the 11th Amendment decisions a little bit more correct than the early Rehnquist court had done. And so we've got two cases decided, a Central Virginia College saying allowing that the exercise of bankruptcy power under Article I can abrogate state sovereign immunity. And if you accept my principle articulation of federalism, that federalism is leaving the states the powers that were not delegated to the national government, a federal question abrogation of state sovereign immunity seems to be the correct answer. And Central Virginia College goes that direction a little bit. Am I running out?
Yep.
I got about a minute. Okay. Now let me take on one other set of cases that I think lets us think about federalism in a little bit different way than we normally do. And these are criminal cases or death penalty cases. Now, these things are all decided under various provisions of the Bill of Rights as incorporated via the 14th Amendment. But we must confess that there's no explicit language in the 14th Amendment that actually governs a lot of these cases. The more amorphous the text, the more broad-reaching we read things into that text, the more we infringe on states' authority to kind of balance their criminal law as they see fit. And we've had a series of these cases where the Roberts Court has actually overruled federal appellate court decisions that really were intruding on state judgments about their appropriateness of criminal law. Now, you might be tempted to write off all these as mostly overruling Judge Reinhardt out on the Ninth Circuit, but I think there's a lot more going on with these cases than that. And I think if you look carefully at them, you find that the Roberts Court, in an area that we have normally not considered as federalism cases, reviving the notion that basic decisions about the criminal law, the exercise of the police powers, can be subjected to certain ultimate authority of the federal constitution, but when we get into the details of regulating how significant the library for prisoners has to be, or how much balance to give to aggravating versus mitigating factors, or what kind of mix of a three-judge cocktail is appropriate, when the federal courts start making those determinations, you are intruding on some pretty basic federal decisions or state police power decisions. So I said, I think the Rehnquist Court has done a good job in reviving that aspect of states' ability to control their police powers. However, the last word on this currently comes last term with Justice Kennedy's opinion in Kennedy versus Louisiana, telling the state of Louisiana that they can't use the death penalty as the ultimate punishment of somebody that commits rape of an 8-year-old. And there's no language in the text of the Constitution that actually decides that, But I think we should be looking at those kind of cases as federalism cases as much as anything else if we're going to ultimately get them right again. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was delighted when Dean Reuter set for me an especially juicy topic for this afternoon, and that is the following. Is Justice Scalia's commitment to federal preemption in tension with his commitment to federalism and states' rights? And I was delighted when Dean gave me this topic because I want to argue that the answer is yes, and that it reflects a more basic tension within conservative legal activism over the past couple of decades, which allows me to refer to a movement, the very mention of which I know drives you guys crazy, and that is the project to resurrect what some have called the Constitution in Exile. I love coming to the Federalist Society and saying Constitution in Exile because you get hisses and no, shocked, this doesn't exist, this is a figment of your imagination, Jeff, and Cass Sunstein in the New York Times photo department, this is the claim. But I want to argue today, and I'm going to persuade you this time, that regardless, this is my big chance, regardless of what you call it, I don't care whether it's the Constitution in Exile or the cuddly Barney teddy bear movement, I want to say that beginning in the 1980s, conservatives were united on a deregulatory project. There was a general suspicion of regulation, but there was a fundamental disagreement about whether it was best to pursue that through the courts with an allegiance to states' rights or to federal power more generally. And that's the tension that Walter identified between broad deregulatory commitments and federalism commitments. And it seems to me that Justice Scalia has been perfectly consistent here, beginning with his days as the editor of Regulation Magazine, which many called deregulation, and tracing back to a particular date in 1984 when he debated Richard Epstein at the Cato Institute. His commitments were clear. This was this wonderful debate at Cato where Scalia went first, and he challenged libertarians to be consistent in repudiating economic judicial activism. He said Lochner had to remain dormant, and conservatives should be careful as they gain control of the courts not to resurrect it. Epstein took strong issue with this. He said that there were many legal doctrines that were ripe for resurrection, many regulations that were ripe for the kill, as he put it, and by resurrecting property rights, limits on commerce power, and states' rights, including judicious economic judicial activism, conservatives would be better off. So it wasn't obvious, as John Eastman has said, during the early Rehnquist years, which of these two strains in the conservative deregulatory project would be ascendant. Would it be the states' rights crowd or the federal deregulatory crowd? And many people were misled when, in the wake of Lopez, the Rehnquist court struck down between 1995 and 2003 33 federal laws, after having struck down none in the previous years between 1937 and 1995. But it soon became obvious that the enthusiasm for the states' rights conservatives, whose intellectual hero is Richard Epstein and whose judicial exponent is Justice Thomas, who, after all, cited Richard Epstein's work in his confirmation hearings, that victory was short-lived, and the death of the states' rights phase of the deregulatory project was, of course, Raich, when in Raich the court rejected the pre-New Deal vision of the Commerce Clause and unequivocally reaffirmed Wickard. It was obvious that that particular strain of states' rights limits on congressional power wasn't going to go anywhere. This also wasn't surprising because, aside from the principal devotees at the Federalist Society and heroic intellectuals like Richard Epstein, there really was no national constituency for this states' rights vision. But at the very moment that the states' rights vision died, the federal preemption vision of the deregulatory project was resurrected with a vengeance. And there is indeed a long pedigree here. My friend Robin Conrad from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is here. She and her colleagues did such good work for 30 years to try to focus the interest of the court on business issues, to deploy any doctrine, statutory or constitutional, toward fighting excessive regulation by litigation. And I want to argue to you that Justice Scalia, both intellectually and jurisprudentially, has been very sympathetic to that project. So the cases that seem especially significant to me, here's what I would say about Scalia. We know that he has rarely met a preemption claim he doesn't like, unlike Justice Thomas, who's expressed skepticism of some of them. And Scalia, broadly, I would say, has three principles which he's willing to sacrifice when they come into conflict with his deregulatory instincts. And the first is that he is a moderate federalist. He believes in states' rights up to a point, as Lopez and Morrison show. But at the same time, he insists on national authority to trump that on issues that he care about. And that, I think, explains his vote, his dissenting vote in Gonzales and Oregon. Second, he generally believes in Chevron deference, but he's willing to abandon that when that comes into conflict with his deregulatory instincts. And the two cases I'd cite there would be Brown and Williamson, the tobacco case, where he silently joined the majority opinion that there was no FDA jurisdiction over tobacco, and surely more significantly, the Rapinos case, where he was willing to defer neither to Congress nor to the executive, but instead to embrace what I would call as a fairly tortured statutory construction, just to deny the ability of regulation over wetlands. And the third commitment is this general and vocal and inspiring commitment to originalism and textualism, but there too he will relax or abandon that in cases like the sovereign immunity and 11th Amendment cases, when he's more interested in limiting access to the courts than in being a consistent originalist. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that Justice Scalia is nakedly unprincipled in any way. He's broadly committed to these principles, but he does have these strong deregulatory instincts. So sometimes he'll come out the other way. His dissent in Bush, in BMW and Gore, he certainly did not dissent in Bush and Gore. The BMW and Gore dissent, where he said that there was no due process limitations on punitive damages, shows that he really doesn't like substantive due process and is willing to be principled there, although I wonder whether his opinion in the Exxon case is entirely consistent with that. But broadly, I want to say he's more, Walter, obviously I know you think it is, but yes, of course it is, and Walter will tell us, Walter will tell us why. Broadly, he's more of a deregulatory guy than a states' rights guy, and he's more of a deregulatory guy than an originalist Chevron deference person, and he is a federalist. What about the future? Walter raised an interesting question for liberals. Will they be as suspicious, will they be as dedicated to states' rights when the people who are brandishing them are not just Ralph Nader, but those questioning the new regulations of the Obama administration? My question is from the opposite point of view. Will Justice Scalia be as committed to deference to federal authority and agency action when the agencies that he's asked to defer to are re-regulating rather than deregulating? I hope very much that he will, and he will prove to be as consistent a nationalist under President Obama as he was under President Bush. If he is, ladies and gentlemen, I'll make a little deal with you. I can say that the Constitution in Exile movement is officially dead if not only Justice Scalia but the rest of the Roberts Court prove to be principled in this way, but I'm not sure. So I'll end just by expressing the hope that I hope and expect that Scalia will be as deferential to President Obama as he has been to the deregulatory President Bush. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm inclined to think that Jeff fell just short of his claim to provide us with photographic evidence that Bigfoot exists. But we can quibble about that later. What I'd like to do here in my 10 minutes is try to do three things. Just very briefly, sketch my own sort of view of the trajectory of the middle, late Rehnquist courts and the Roberts courts. Talk a little bit about the early evidence from the Roberts court, and then maybe talk a couple of minutes about the preemption cases. Let me start with the trajectory of the Roberts Court. You've heard this in varying forms from all of the different speakers, and I'm tempted to omit my discussion of it in deference to avoid repetition, but I think the interesting thing is that my own sort of version of it is a little bit different than everyone else's, and everyone else's is a little bit different from everyone else's, and I think it just shows that maybe it's a little hard to characterize cases as federalism cases or not. My classification goes a little like this. You had what I would sort of refer to as the mid-Rehnquist court, which was kind of the high watermark for federalism cases. And I'd identify the obvious Lopez and Morrison cases. I guess unlike Dean Eastman, I would probably also identify cases like Bernie and Garrett, the 11th Amendment cases, as also being cases where the court was in a pro-federalism mode and upholding limits on the federal government's ability to impose damage remedies on the states. So that's, I think, where we would maybe classify those cases a little different. Because of the way I classify those cases, it seems to me that that period really was the high watermark for federalism. I think then if you look at the late Rehnquist court, you see a very different story emerging, most obviously from the Raich case and its difference in treatment from the Lopez and Morrison cases. But I guess also, again, in my way of looking at it, cases like Hibbs and Tennessee against Lane, where the Supreme Court starts allowing damages actions against state governments in certain circumstances, to me, I read that as further evidence that the high watermark of the Rehnquist court federalism days had passed. With that observation, though, let me make one sort of important qualification. I think there was a tendency, including at Federalist Society events, to really, you know, overread Lopez and Morrison when they first came out and think, boy, this is the dawning of a new day. And I think there's equally been a tendency to overrule Raich and say, boy, you know, it's all over. This whole thing is ended. And I guess I could feel more confident about the first point because, you know, Raich comes along, and I think there are very many people that thought that that was a betrayal of Lopez and Morrison. And in some ways, I'm tempted to ask, did you read Lopez? And in particular, did you read the concurrences in Lopez? Because there were pretty clear signals, at least from Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor, that Lopez was a fairly limited decision. And just how limited a decision became clear when Justice Kennedy, among others, shows up in the majority in the Raich decision. And I think in some ways, in understanding the trajectory of Lopez, Morrison to Raich, one thing to keep an eye on is the composition of the majority in that case. I mean, a five-justice majority that includes Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy is not always one that is going to be taken to every bit of its logical conclusion. And I actually think it's kind of interesting because I think roughly at the same time that Lopez comes out, another important case comes out in the Supreme Court in a very different jurisprudential area, the Apprendi case. And when Lopez comes out, a lot of people ask, boy, does this mean there's going to be a substantial rolling back of kind of the role of the federal government? And some people said yes, some people said no. When Apprendi comes out, a couple of people read it and said, gee whiz, I wonder if this means that the federal sentencing guidelines are unconstitutional. Now, to my mind, almost everybody said, nah, couldn't be. And when you look at this, I think, you know, you can disagree, but I think the vast majority of people said, nah, couldn't be. Every court of appeals in the wake of Apprendi and pre-Blakely upheld the federal sentencing guidelines. So there's some evidence for you. But lo and behold, we get Blakely and then we get Booker. I think if you look at the majority in Apprendi, though, you may get some of your answer there. Because the justices, the unusual justices that made up that five-justice majority, Scalia, Thomas, Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg, are justices that I think, all things being equal, are likely to take a proposition all the way to the end, even if there are substantial practical ramifications for that holding. So I think that is a difference in those two cases. The Roberts Court, I think my headline on the trajectory of the Roberts Court is it's just too darn early to tell. We have a couple of Section 5 cases that sort of point in different directions. The Katz case looks like it's a backing away from, even more substantial than in Lane and Hibbs, from the case law of Bernie and Garrett. But then you have the United States against Georgia case, another Section 5 case, which sort of muddies the water even further. You have cases like Rapanos and Medellin, but as Dean Eastman put out, it's kind of hard to know what Rapanos even means, as evidenced by the fact that the court has the same basic question back in front of them because the circuit courts have split over how to interpret the Rapanos decision. And the Medellin case, which could have been, I think, a big federalism case, I think ends up being more of a separation of powers case than a federalism case, the way that Chief Justice Roberts wrote the case. So I think it is really too early to tell. One way to try to answer the question, though, of what the Roberts Court is going to look like on federalism issues is to look at it this way, which is the Roberts Court, as we now have it, has two members who weren't on the Rehnquist Court. If you look at the justices that were replaced from the Rehnquist Court to the Roberts Court, it is hard to be too optimistic that the Roberts Court is going to be substantially more pro-federalist, because Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor, certainly the earlier Justice O'Connor more I think particularly, were two pretty strong votes for states and its pretty strong views about federalism. Now, so far, the returns, I think, are too early to tell on Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito as to where they will be. But I think, at least in part of their strong kind of federal background before they took the bench, it's a little hard to be too sort of bullish about the extent to which they're going to be more states' rights, more pro-federalism than the justices that they ended up replacing. Certainly time will tell. I think if you look at the Chief Justice, though, Chief Justice Roberts and his early votes in federalism cases, I think that it is, again, I think maybe hard to predict that he's going to end up substantially more pro-federalist than Chief Justice Rehnquist. There's certainly some cases where I think it would be hard to think that there would be any difference in the votes cast. If you look at the Katz decision on the 11th Amendment or the Rapanos decision about the geographical scope of the Clean Water Act, the jurisdictional reach of the Clean Water Act, my guess is that Chief Justice Rehnquist would have voted the exact same way in those two cases. But there are other cases where I think it's less clear. We've talked a lot about Gonzales against Oregon. The fact that the Chief Justice was in dissent in that case, in a case that I think properly understood probably is a federalism case, not just an administrative regulation case, I think is of some interest, and again, in part because the returns are early and all we can do is look at the few precincts we have reporting at this point. Another case, which no one else will probably mention this whole weekend, is the Danforth against Minnesota case, kind of an obscure criminal procedure case. But here the question is basically whether state courts can have their own rules about retroactivity on collateral review. It's basically whether Teague applies in state courts applying to, you know, claims that are brought under state habeas, even though the underlying claim is a federal constitutional claim. If I haven't lost you, the punchline here is that there are only two votes that thought that state courts had to follow federal rules when they were having their own state collateral review provisions. And one of those two votes was Chief Justice Roberts. So I think that is, again, perhaps a very early return, perhaps a tea leaf too obscure for most, but I think that it is some evidence. And the last thing I would point to is the Medellin decision itself, because there was a decision that could have very easily been a decision that was principally and foremost about federalism. And I think if you read that decision, you will conclude that it is foremost about international law and self-executing treaties, and second most about separation of powers and what the president can do. But the discussion of federalism is very much submerged in that case, and I don't think it needed to be so. The last thing I will say, and my watch tells me I have 1 minute left, is to just talk about preemption for 1 second. And I guess maybe we can talk about more of this in the panel discussion. But I would like to just offer the contrary perspective that I don't think there's anything inherently contradictory about a justice taking a view that is, in some of these areas, like the 11th Amendment or Commerce Clause or the like, to take the view that the federal government's powers are limited, but then also to take a view that is more likely at the margins to find federal law preempting. And I would summarize why there isn't an inherent contradiction this way. If you have a view that federal government power ought to be limited, then a starting place for understanding where the federal government ought to regulate are those areas where the federal government has to regulate uniformly. Because if the states regulates on their own, you'll have races to the bottom, races to the top, or other collective action problems. And if you have a view that the federal government really ought to get involved almost only where it plays a necessary role in providing uniform rules, then I think you're likely to conclude that those uniform federal rules ought to preempt state law. So with those thoughts, I'll sit down.
Well, I want to thank the panelists for staying within their due bounds time-wise. Those who are conversant with such things, are the table mics working? It would help
Duke,
if they were.
Duke, yes.
Okay. We can judge the age of the panelists by the choice of test. Walter, you had to go first, so you get to comment first or question, whatever you'd like to do to your fellow panelists.
All right. Well, small note to Jeff Rosen. I love defending Justice Scalia from attack at the Federalist Society. I think his votes in the punitive damages cases from the states, where he has taken the position that the 14th Amendment's broad generalities do not license courts to set aside state policy choices, is perfectly consistent with his position in Exxon to limit, to reduce the amount by 90% of the punitive damages in that case, where it was a matter of, that as we emphasized from day one, a federal maritime law, where necessarily judges have to make their own determinations, and that distinguished it. Indeed, the fact that he believes that punitive damages should be limited in that way shows the consistency of his restraint in not invalidating state judgments on punitive damages, liberated by being a common law maritime judge, as he was uniquely in the Valdez case. He comes to a different position.
So it's a wonderful defense, and we now all owe Walter $20,000.
I think more generally, when we think about federalism, from the time of the founding to now, there are reasons that people act instrumentally when it comes to federalism. We have lost, between 1790 and now, the purpose of states' rights and federalism to a significant degree. That is, in 1790, the anti-federalists who opposed the Constitution on behalf of states' rights did so on behalf of a different conception of government, a different relationship of the people to the governed. In the states, you had, under those state constitutions of 1776, the most populous governments we've ever seen. Those people believed that direct democracy was most desirable. So you had annual elections. You had instructed delegates. You had recall. You had weak governors, often appointed by the legislature. You had courts that were elected, and quite consciously so, to be kept on a short leash of the people. The notion you had large legislative assemblies, so that each legislator was elected from a small constituency, an ordinary person. Contrast that with the Madison-Hamilton vision of a national government that is Burkean in its approach, where you have 2 years between the election of members of the House. You have 6-year senators, an indirectly elected president, judges with life tenure, all designed to provide some distance from the government, and vastly large legislative districts with relatively few legislators. So, as Madison said, only the worthy and the great will be elected. And as the anti-federalists charged, only the worthy and the great will be elected. It was a very jury trial was about people serving immediate. So the government at the state level was of a different kind than government at the national level. And yet now they are indistinguishable in the quality of that you are as close to your congressman as you are to your state representative. You have in some ways more ability to connect directly to the Obama or McCain campaign than you can to find out who your county commissioner is. The size of our states is such that they no longer have a different kind of necessary relationship. So, which is not to say that federalism doesn't serve purposes, but the purposes that made it so vital at the time of the founding are no longer there. And then we have the 14th Amendment, which is an enormous incursion on state authority and granting to the courts and Congress great authority.
I'll now move arbitrarily and capriciously.
All right. I want to take on the federal preemption cases. I was at a judge's conference a week ago where my debate opponent accused the conservatives on the court for being hypocrites for their preemption decisions. And that seems to be grossly simplistic. I mean, you have to look at what it is that's being preempted and what the source of the federal regulation or statute's power is on whether it's appropriate for preemption. And so if there's something like a labeling of a drug that's moving in interstate commerce, that seems to be pretty clearly within the commerce power. And I'm about as stingy on the scope of commerce power as anybody. And so if it's explicit, that should be easy. The problems arise when it's not an explicit preemption, and you got all these implied preemption doctrines, and a conflict preemption's easy, but the other ones, how big is the field that was intended? If it's implicit, now you're talking about preempting state policy decisions, not because they are within federal power, but within the potential exercise of federal power that hasn't actually been exercised yet. And now that's a transfer of power from Congress, who ought to be making those decisions, to the courts, who ought not. And the biggest context of that implied preemption exists in the whole dormant commerce clause arena. If you think about it, I mean, this is the court's strike. Now, we find, there are some good friends of mine in this room who are big keen on, dormant commerce clause cases to get wine traveling across interstate lines, and that's a good thing. But we have to recognize what a turning upside down of the federal system it is if we're now letting courts make basic police power exercise decisions for the states without an explicit act of the elected officials in Congress to do so. This is an unbelievably broad implied preemption without even the statutory or regulatory hook that existed. So I think we've got to be much more nuanced before we can call the conservatives hypocrites on their preemption cases. This is an exercise of power clearly within the Commerce Clause. You've got to then cut in favor of preemption. Now, the second category of those things, and not the implied preemption, is when the exercise of the power is itself pretty tenuous. And I would love to see, for example, the labeling of a drug that's moved in interstate commerce can easily be preempted. But the requirement of a sign that gets put in the doctor's office seems to be a much more tenuous connection to the exercise of commerce among the states' power. And I'd love to see a Lopez analysis on the front end of those cases involving the back end preemption claims. I don't see that coming out of the Roberts Court. So when I say that early Rehnquist Court's idea of federalism and the limits on federal power is not coming to the forefront here, it's in those kind of cases that I'm talking about.
Thank you, Dean. Moving right along with the order in which we have gone before, we're going to take Jeff up next. I'm going to cheat just a little bit and interfere a little bit myself at this point. I think moderator ought to be exacerbators at time. Jeff's references to the Constitution in exile have given me an opportunity to say something in public I've been thinking in private quite some time. I'm not sure what the Constitution in exile movement is. I do know that the first time I ever heard of it was when a legal writer, it may have been Jeff, I'm not sure, described me as a leader of it. It's a bit confusing to try to lead a movement that you never heard of before. It reminded me of the time that the First Lady said there was a vast right-wing conspiracy, which she then identified as consisting of two senators and a judge from North Carolina who had lunch together. And I would say that I've gotten about as much benefit out of being the leader of a movement I never heard of as I did out of being a member of a conspiracy that met in the Senate dining room. That said, Jeff, what was it you convinced us all of? I lost track somewhere along the way.
Well, what I've convinced you of, since no one has disputed it, since it's the same thing that Walter began with.
We didn't know what it was.
Well, let me repeat it. Okay. It's that there are these two conservative legal movements that you guys have been at the forefront of. One has marched under the banner of states' rights, and the other has marched under the banner of deregulation. And I don't care what you call this, whether you say it's the Constitution in Exile movement, the states' rights movement, the deregulation movement. The truth is that these are movements. There are books written about them, many by conservative scholars. There are litigation groups set up to forward these views, and they have representatives in the appellate courts and on the Supreme Court today. And the question that I think I've convinced you of that because no one has disputed that these strains in conservative legalism exist. Again, the label does not seem important to me. The question that we're talking about today, and I don't pretend to convince you of this because it's a hard question, is the one that John Eastman just raised. Is it hypocritical to embrace strains of both these movements? Can you at times be a states' rights conservative and at other times be a deregulation conservative? And I think, maybe hypocrite is too strong, but I have to say, Justice Scalia told us that his entire jurisprudence was staked on the idea that he would reach results that he disagreed with when the methodology compelled it. And, of course, his famous example in the culture war cases is flag burning. Justice Scalia is a conservative guy, he says, but he allows people to burn flags. I'm troubled, I have to tell you, frankly, that in the cases we've been discussing, these federalism and regulation cases, it's hard to come up with lots of examples, I know and hope you will, of cases where Justice Scalia reaches results that are inconsistent with his general deregulatory instincts. He seems to pick and choose among the states' rights and deregulation methodologies, as the Oregon case shows, as Rapinos shows, based on the result. And in this regard, I would distinguish Justice Scalia from Justice Thomas, who is a principled states' rights conservative. I mean, he has the courage of his convictions. He's willing to take his Lopez concurrence wherever it goes. And his dissents in some of the preemption cases signal to me his consistency. I would end this thought by saying the proof is in the pudding, and we'll find out under President Obama the following. Imagine the kinds of challenges that are likely to come to the re-regulatory efforts of the Obama administration. If there's a 90-day moratorium on mortgage foreclosures, as the president-elect has suggested, someone, whether you want to call him a constitution in exile guy or a states' rights guy, it might challenge that as a taking. Some district court judge, again, I don't care what the label is, might go for it. What would Justice Scalia do in a case like that? I think I'm confident he would do. He would reject the claim. Justice Thomas might be more sympathetic to it. Or imagine the kind of cases that are going to come from the financial crisis with people suing the bond rating agencies for having inflated the value of those bonds. Are new doctrines going to be created to keep people out of court, expanding Stone Ridge and so forth? I'm just saying that we'll soon know whether the results in these cases turn on the sympathy for the economic result, deregulation versus re-regulation, or with a really principled and consistent dedication to a methodology. But Judge, just on the Constitution and Exile point, I'm happy to forswear the label if you at the Federalist Society will stop denying one of your greatest achievements, which is these two movements which have really transformed the law over the past 30 years.
Paul?
Let me try to add three quick thoughts. One, and I think this echoes something that Dean Eastman said, is that, you know, it's a little hard to make predictions about the Roberts Court, in part because, as I said, the early returns are limited. Probably the area where you have the most kind of greatest number of cases is in the preemption area. But the preemption cases are actually kind of difficult to draw too much from because, at bottom, most of them end up being statutory construction cases. It's pretty much common ground among everyone on the court that where Congress has the power, and the current court has a more robust view of the Congress's power than, say, Dean Eastman. So where Congress has the power, if they're explicit enough about what they want to do in preempting state law, it's pretty much agreed that Congress gets to do it. And that's why a very important case like Regal last term in the medical device context can be decided 8-1. There's broad agreement on this Supreme Court that if Congress is clear about it, it can have preemptive effect. And so when these cases get decided not 8-1 but 5-4, I'm not sure that it signals some seismic shift in where the justices are on federalism, but it shows a difference in how clear they think the statute either is or needs to be. So I think it's easy to overread those. Second, let me make one more try at making the point that these two legal movements that Jeff talks about are really not inherently in tension. They may be in certain cases, sure, but in some ways the question in a lot of these preemption cases is as follows. What sense does it make to have 51 entities regulating something? And it is, I think, a fairly consistent way of looking at it that, you know, maybe the answer should be 1 or 50, but not 51. And where you draw the line between 1 and 50 People can disagree about that. And surely there are some areas where there are going to be concurrent regulation and should be concurrent regulation, and the Constitution's explicit in allowing it. But I think one way of thinking about it is the preemption cases really are asking not whether there should be regulation or deregulation generally, but who should be the regulator, and should there be all sorts of them, or should there be every state to regulate its own, or should it be the federal government alone that does the regulation? The last point I will offer is just an observation about another case in this area that may be coming down the pike. We've seen some cases that fit this categorization. I think if the presidential election had come out differently, we'd be certain to see cases like this. Maybe now with the Congress and the presidency in Democratic hands, we won't. But these are the cases where a state is regulating something and trying to regulate activity outside that state on the express understanding that the federal government's not doing enough. And the greenhouse gases case are a particularly good example of that. The Garamendi case from a couple of terms ago, I think, actually fits this characterization. What was going on there, and I think the reason the court decided it the way it did, although it was close, is that California really wasn't trying to regulate California insurance companies. The state of California was basically trying to regulate German insurance companies. And that's something that I think at least a bare majority of the court thought was not something that a state government ought to be doing.
David. Next item on the agenda would be to take the questions from the audience. If anybody has 1 minute's worth on the panel, they feel like they just have to. I don't see anybody jumping into the breach, so we'll be taking questions from the audience. There are mics in at least two, maybe three locations. Right here we have a line. You can go first, sir.
Well, the Constitution in Exile is at least represented on Constitution.org and in Judge Andrew Napolitano's book. So it has gotten more than just a casual mention in the discussion here. But to characterize one of the two branches as deregulatory doesn't really do justice to it, because it's not just deregulation at the federal level. What some of us read into the Ninth Amendment as something that should be incorporated toward the states is a general right to a presumption of non-authority, an expression of which would be a resurrection of the ancient prerogative writ of quo warranto, whereby any person could go to court and demand that any official prove his authority by an unbroken logical chain of derivation from a constitution, and if he is unable to do so, either be enjoined from further action or removed from his position. And this would apply to federal, state, local, or private officials. So we're talking about much more than just federal deregulation. We're talking
about. I don't have an exact time limit for audience members, but you're pushing whichever one it is. So.
Okay.
If you would wrap up, sir, in one sentence.
Like to get the panel's reaction to the idea of resurrecting the Ninth Amendment as an approach to addressing these issues.
At any particular one of you want to go jump first on the Ninth Amendment?
I'll take that up. The Ninth Amendment, to read that into the Ninth Amendment, I think is to do a great disservice to what the founders accomplished. Those questions about the scope of state power were reserved to the states. And you could have state constitutions that were of limited authority. You could also have state constitutions that were general in authority in their delegation of power to the state government. And we specifically choose a system at the national level that leaves that open for people in their individual states to decide. If you're going to buy the notion of federalism that, you devolve power to the lowest level, you also devolve the decisions about how much power to give to the local governments as well.
Anybody else want to buy it on that, or Jeff?
I think it was such a great question because it reminds us the scope and ambition of the movement, the X movement, whatever you want to call it, in its most serious form. That was a good libertarian defense, and Roger Pilon will provide an even better one in a moment. of the idea that not only the Ninth Amendment and the Commerce Clause, but there are all these constitutional doctrines and statutory approaches that will resurrect lost liberties and deny regulation, as the gentleman said, at the state, federal, and local level. This is why it is a problem. Paul is doing an excellent job, probably a persuasive job, of giving a plausible theoretical justification for how you could be a moderate states' rights guy and a moderate preemption guy, and it would make some regulatory or economic sense. But Justice Scalia is not in that position. He staked his claim not only on originalism, but also on judicial restraint and economic matters. And that's why he balked at Cato, of all places, with Richard Epstein, because Richard Epstein was confronting him with the implication of the theories, and he suddenly saw that it was Lochner. And the gentleman who asked the question and Roger like Lochner, but Scalia is completely opposed to that, and that's why he can't just pick and choose and always end up conveniently at the deregulatory result.
Yeah, unless I see somebody dying to answer, I'll call on the next person in line.
I'm Clark Forsyth, and I want to ask a question to the entire panel, maybe starting with Jeff. How will the Roberts Court apply federalism principles to the proposed Federal Freedom of Choice Act, which would not replace states with a regulatory scheme, but would sweep away hundreds of state regulations on which the court has repeatedly said the states have legitimate or compelling interests to protect?
Walter knows this much better than I, but I would. This is a really good test, and you cannot be a race conservative and strike down the Freedom of Choice Act. Justice Thomas could do it and be consistent with his previous opinions, but if any of the other, if Roberts, Alito, Scalia did that, I'd have to say, my goodness, after all those lectures about Roe v. Wade and separating personal preferences from jurisprudential conclusions, you guys really have disappointed here. So I would not bet that there'd be more than one or two votes to strike it down, but if there were, I'd be very disappointed and surprised. Walter, what do you think of that?
I thought 16, 18 years ago that the Freedom of Choice Act would clearly be within Congress's power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which I read at the time that the one institution of government mentioned is Congress. The point was to empower as a radical amendment intended to empower Congress, to give Congress broad legislative authority, and that Congress could enact that. City of Bernie versus Flores and the succeeding opinions, I think, changed that calculation considerably. So I no longer have anywhere near the confidence I had at the time that that the act would be sustained, because there's a very different view of Congress's power under the 14th Amendment. A sort of, I would call, jurocentric view of the 14th Amendment, where the court sees itself as the principal actor under an amendment intended to empower Congress. But that's the universe we live in.
Anybody else dying to comment? If not, then Roger.
Okay. I want to pick up on Paul's second point of just a minute ago to suggest to Jeff that his report on the death of the Constitution in Exile movement is premature. The phrase comes, Judge Sentell, from your colleague, Doug Ginsburg, in a review in Regulation Magazine in 1995, which was then published by the Cato Institute.
I probably didn't read it in 95, and if I did, I've forgotten it by now. But in any event, the first time I recall hearing it, I was described as a leader in the movement. And the
declining memory is not uncommon in this room. In any event, I can understand how you might have thought of that, Jeff, from looking so much at the Scalia jurisprudence, because Scalia was, of course, a sometime member of the Constitution in Exile movement. You pointed to the Scalia-Epstein debate. I know a little bit about that because I put that conference together. And Scalia is the true believer, or rather, Epstein is the true member, not Scalia. But the larger issue, it seems to me, is that we really haven't come to grips with what we're talking about with federalism here. And I think that the reason we're not is because people like Scalia don't, in my judgment, have a correct understanding of it. It means federal power where it's authorized, state power when it's authorized, and finally, no state power where the federal government is necessary under the 14th Amendment to negate state power. And there's where Scalia has a difficulty, because he is so antipathetic to substantive due process, which really should be done under the Privileges and Immunities Clause, that he can't come to grips with that third element of federalism. So perhaps you'd care to respond.
Just to say thank you so much, Roger. Finally, in front of the entire Federalist Society, a leader of the movement has embraced the title and said that it's not going far enough. Can we end these hisses and claims that it doesn't exist? All right, no, they're too much fun to keep. We can do it year after year. No, this was the original piece used Roger and his colleagues.
Jeff, I would like you to point to me which way it's going so I can run in front of it.
You're always in front of us, Jez. There's no question about that. The original piece profiled Roger and Clint and all the good people at Cato as the purists in this movement, and they've been disappointed from the beginning that Justice Scalia and others on the court have fallen short of the true faith, as all justices do. It's their job to be heroically principled and uncompromising, and the judge's job to disappoint them. So anyway, we're not agreeing. Of course, you just proved the point, Roger. As to where it's going, I guess my only thought was that the federalism side of it is dead, aside from you wonderful guys keeping the faith for constitutional and theoretical reasons about the importance of federalism for its own sake. The debate, partly because of the appointments of Roberts and Alito, has shifted more to the deregulatory preemption side of things. And I think that that's will get
that's
you some
thing.
Of the results you want, but will disappoint you even more in other ones, and in that sense is just a sign of the way things are going.
Well, I see Walter straining to reply here.
Well, I don't know if there's a movement of which Judge Sintel is a leader. I do hear you refer to as El Jefe, which I think may be the exile leadership that you're denying here. My question back to Roger, to the larger panel, is why is it that states' rights ever became thought of as a, quote, conservative notion? For the first 150 years of the country, the reverse was true. It's profoundly ahistorical in the following sense. There was, in the 1780s and 90s, a party, loosely using that phrase, that was for commerce, it was for industry, it was for strong money, it was against redistribution, it was for property rights, and that party saw the national government or a strong nationalist approach as absolutely essential to what it was doing. There was a party that favored debtors, that was more redistributionist, that was more populist, that wanted to elect judges, that didn't believe in secured rights, but more populist democracy at the whim. And that was the party of states' rights. And it feared that the national government would appoint judges with life tenure who would invalidate ameliorative social programs adopted by the states in defense of property. And so it was for 150 years. If the framers had come alive in 1929 or 1935, they would have thought, this is great. Federal judges appointed for life are striking down incursions on property rights and striking down redistributive projects, so that states' rights was never seen as a conservative doctrine nearly as much until the Civil Rights era.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well,
when it was used then both liberals
Walter,
and conservatives in that way. So that's
Roger,
my point is,
understood states' the audience rights gets one shot. There's another guy lined up behind you, and it's his turn. I noticed when you stood at that mic, and I thought you were going to try that.
So. Well, he asked me a question.
Yeah. He has his chance.
Roger, I hope I do you justice, because I was afraid you were going to steal my fire when you responded. And I find myself oddly having to attack some analysis that Dean Eastman made, as well as Jeff Rosen, regarding the nature of federalism. And I think federalism, at least in the eyes of the founder, and potentially even as under 14th Amendment analysis as well, which I believe was 51, Madison said that it was a double security. It wasn't a one-way street. Federalism is not at all analogous with states' rights. It doesn't. It is not saying that the devolutionary power is the correct power. I think in general we might agree that power that is closer to the people is more accessible, than is more democratic. But as a practical matter, they were to be set against each other just as the separation of powers envisioned. And so in that, and then you might say, but wait a second, state courts can't go around invalidating the Supreme Court. It's not a two-way street in the judiciary. But look at Kelo. I mean, look at how the state courts have got it right, in my humble opinion, when, it, you know, even both before and I think even in light of the downhill run from Kelo. So I do think it's potentially a two-way street. And I do think that, and Jeff, the distinction I was going to capitalize that you made was between a kind of deregulatory and states rights agenda. I think there's some conflict for Scalia, even in my interpretation, but I view federalism quite differently.
Okay. Who wants to shoot first?
I don't think we're disagreeing. You're going to have some federal and state tensions, and the purpose of both of those tensions is to secure individual liberty, right? But the scope of the state's power in order to weigh into that game is a function of what the state citizens have given to them. And that's where the devolution piece comes in. And I don't think there's any dispute about it. How broad a state police power, you know, I think one of the fallacies is that the presumption has to be a libertarian one. That's a question that's left up to the individual states on how they sort out that balance. And I think that may be the point of our disagreement. But if you accept the premise that where that balance gets designed or decided is at the state level, not a federal judge interpreting the Ninth Amendment, then we're in perfect agreement.
Jeff, you're nodding.
That's right. No, I'm thinking, which is better than nodding, perhaps. If the presumption is individual liberty, then you don't dissent in the medical marijuana case, obviously. Then you're, and obviously I know you didn't agree with it. But that's what makes me think that you're picking and choosing among the strands. But I do think, look, these are strands that can be reconciled in the way that you did very elegantly and Paul did too, but it's not like they're seamless. So Justice Thomas and Lopez is more like John Calhoun than James Madison, and the tradition that he's part of is much more of the prebellum South than of the founders. And I guess that's what I say. I wouldn't deny the tensions among these strands in the movement.
Anybody else? All right, there's time left, nobody to mic. Roger, you get to come back up.
I guess this is the exercise of equity, right? To answer your question, Walter, is how is it became a conservative baggage, if you will. It's because of the Nixon-Southern strategy in response to the civil rights movement, and it's plagued the larger conservative libertarian movement ever since.
Wasn't it really before Nixon that it became a conservative movement?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was the, sure,
yeah, Nixon, yeah,
there
Nixon
were the Southern Democrats.
Across party lines, but the Southern Democrats.
The billboards in the South in the 50s condemning Chief Justice
Earl Warren.
And it's because, you know, states' rights has a terrible baggage, and that's not what federalism is really all about. It's about power belonging where it belongs, either the federal government or the state government or neither.
Yeah, I think you and the prior speaker and everybody else have convinced us that states' rights and federalism are not synonymous.
No.
No, that's good.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So,
anyone else want to take the microphone? Anyone else on the panel want to take a crack at each other?
Hi. My name is Bill Rivera. I had a question. Given the number of cases the court actually takes up these days, is there circuit splits on any particular issues of federalism that you see creating federalism cases over the next couple of years potentially for this court?
I think Paul referred to the rebound cases from Rapanos. The court's trying to grapple with what Justice Kennedy actually means there. You're inevitably going to get splits. You already are starting to get some splits on that. If you take that principle or unmoored statement of purported principle and try and apply it across a lot of other provisions in the U.S. Code, you could end up with lots of splits. But I don't see this court being quick to jump and taking that and resolving it with a clear line rule, because I think Justice Kennedy is going to remain the center chair, and he's not going to give any greater definition to what he said in the next go around than he said on the last go around, in my view.
Okay.
The only things that I would add to that, if you sort of think about what's coming down the pike, maybe, you know, in a longer term 5 years, I do think the issue I alluded to, even with the Obama administration and the Democrats with both houses of Congress, I think are going to be efforts by states, principally California, because it's in the best position to do it, because California, especially if it can get some states to go along, can really have pretenses of leading on national policy. And I think to the extent that it tries to do that, whether it's in greenhouse gas, auto emissions, whatever it is, and, you know, and maybe the state of the economy will put some natural curb on that too. But one way or another, I think that issue is going to get back to the Supreme Court. Another issue that's kind of lurking out there, this, you know, I may be overestimating people's interest level, but I do think there's a really interesting issue lurking out there in the Section 5 11th Amendment jurisprudence. Because what happened in Bernie and the first set of cases is that the Supreme Court looked at whether or not legislation was appropriate under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, basically on a facial level. And so it looked at the whole statute and asked in the somewhat amorphous test, is it proportional and congruent to the underlying constitutional provision that Congress says it's remedying? Then in Tennessee v. Lane, the court starts to inch towards more of a as-applied approach. And it doesn't ask, is Title II of the ADA congruent and proportional to the underlying constitutional prohibitions on disability discrimination. It looks at a specific context, access to the courts, and says in that context, yes, maybe in other contexts, not. Then in United States against Georgia, they go all the way to total as-applied analysis, and they basically look at one individual prisoner's claim and says, the court says, look, you would have a plausible basis for bringing an Eighth Amendment claim. Therefore, we're going to allow you to bring a Title II of the ADA claim and sue the states for damages. What that means is that the next case that gets up to the Supreme Court is almost guaranteed to be a case testing Congress's Section 5 power in a case where the application of it is purely prophylactic. It basically guarantees that the next time, if it's a Title II ADA case in the prison context, it will be a claim by a prisoner who has no Eighth Amendment claim and only has a Title II of the ADA claim. And I think the very fact that the court's jurisprudence here has moved us to a world where the next case, and I think it'll be in the next couple of terms, is purely prophylactic, I think that in turn will have some impact on how the state, how the court decides the case and how the court looks at Section 5 going forward.
Yeah, I think we're losing the use of the hall, so I want to thank all of the panelists for their contributions to learning today. And thank you very much.